Welcome to the debate. When a cardiologist wants to truly understand the health of a human heart, they don't, you know, just look at it while the patient is resting comfortably in a chair.
Right. They put them on a treadmill.
Exactly. They put that patient on a treadmill. They crank up the speed, they increase the incline, and they run a stress test. They need to see how the system operates under intense, agonizing pressure.
Because that's the only time the hidden fault lines really show themselves.
Precisely. And today, we are putting our global institutions on that exact kind of treadmill. We are diving into a rigorous examination of Dr. Bishara Sahali's 2026 academic white paper,
which is titled No Wound Denied, No Wound Enthroned: Holocaust Memory, Genocide Prevention, and the Life-Coherent Ethics of Non-Disposability.
And it is a deeply uncomfortable stress test. Sehi Lee is asking us to look at international law, collective historical memory, and even modern technology.
Yeah, and he asked this really provocative question. Do these systems actually protect vulnerable human life, or do they just protect themselves?
Exactly. And the central disagreement we are going to explore today revolves around how we apply the profound lessons of the Holocaust to contemporary conflicts.
Right, the core question.
Yes. Does fulfilling the moral obligation of Holocaust memory require universalizing it as an active, preventative stress test for modern atrocities? Or does treating complex modern warfare as a direct parallel to the Holocaust risk dangerous moral equivalencies? Equivalencies that actually dilute the memory's vital historical specificity.
And just to lay our cards on the table, I'll be arguing that inappropriately mapping the specific industrialized mechanisms of the Holocaust onto active conflicts stretches this framework to a breaking point.
And I will be representing the other side. I'll be arguing that memory must be what Sahali calls life coherent. It has to be universally applied to prevent the de-lifing of any group.
Even though we both agree on the baseline principle of universal non-disposability, right? The idea that no human life should be treated as disposable.
Of course. But I argue we frankly cannot afford to wait for perfect historical consensus before we act. Let me start by laying out the foundation of Sahali's perspective, because it fundamentally challenges how we think about the Holocaust.
It really does. It reframes the whole thing.
Yeah, the core thesis here is that the Holocaust wasn't some, you know, inexplicable eruption of primitive savagery outside of civilization. It was a process mediated by civilization itself. Law, science, medicine, corporate bureaucracy, they were all meticulously coordinated.
Right. The paper makes it incredibly clear that the gas chambers didn't just appear out of nowhere. They were preceded by language, by administrative normalization.
Exactly. By the very bureaucratic institutions we usually rely on for social order. And this leads to Sahali's most critical and perhaps most provocative concept. He argues that Holocaust memory becomes pathological when it undergoes something called autopoietic capture.
Which is a heavy term. We should probably unpack that.
Definitely. If you're listening, autopoiesis is actually a biological concept. Think of it like an autoimmune disease. The immune system's entire purpose is to protect the whole body.
But sometimes it gets confused.
Right, it turns inward, and it starts attacking the body to protect its own cellular structure. In this geopolitical context, it means institutions use the sacred, untouchable memory of the Holocaust to protect the state's power.
Rather than using that memory to protect vulnerable human life.
Exactly. I argue that the current situation in Gaza is the ultimate moral stress test of this dynamic. The paper insists on the principle of prevention before certainty. If we wait for a final international legal adjudication, like the pending International Court of Justice merits judgment, we are allowing the atrocity to occur while we debate the paperwork.
I approach this from a very different angle. As I mentioned, the principle of protecting all vulnerable life is the right starting point. But using the Holocaust as a diagnostic template for the war in Gaza is analytically flawed.
But how can we ignore the systemic parallels?
Because Sahali explicitly builds in safeguards against what he calls anti-Semitic collapse. He emphasizes the absolute necessity of distinguishing between the Israeli state, the political ideology of Zionism, and the Jewish people.
I agree with those distinctions.
Right, but the Holocaust was characterized by a highly specific, unique sequence. We're talking centuries of mythic, cosmic accusation, culminating in industrialized state-sponsored extermination. The sole objective was the annihilation of a people.
Sure, the specific historical context was unique.
But when we take that highly specific template and apply it to complex urban warfare, warfare involving embedded armed non-state actors like Hamas operating within civilian infrastructure, we bypass the very historical specificity the paper claims to want to protect.
Wait. I think that line of reasoning ignores the timeline and the actual mechanism of how international law was designed to function in the wake of the Holocaust.
How so?
Well, let's look at the 1948 Genocide Convention. The entire point of the convention, its explicit title, is the prevention and punishment of the crime. It is not just the Autopsy and Punishment Convention.
Okay, but applying that label preemptively has huge consequences.
I mean, look at the timeline we are dealing with. In early 2024, the ICJ issued provisional measures indicating a credible risk to Palestinians in Gaza. By 2025, the UN Human Rights Council's Commission of Inquiry concluded that genocide was taking place.
Israel vehemently rejects those conclusions, though.
I fully acknowledge that. And the final ICJ merits judgment takes years. But if we demand perfect, crystal-clear historical consensus before we invoke the lessons of the Holocaust, then the phrase never again just becomes never again for us. It ceases to be a universal shield.
Look, I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
Go ahead.
The text itself states explicitly Gaza's not Auschwitz. There is a profound danger in rapidly applying the genocide label as a preventative tool because it dilutes the conceptual rigor of the term itself.
Even if the early warning signs are present?
If every severe, devastating conflict with tragic, unacceptably high civilian casualties is treated through the lens of the Holocaust, the distinct warning signs of industrialized, state-sponsored extermination are totally obscured. Genocide isn't just a synonym for mass casualties in war.
Now, of course it's not. But that is exactly where Saheli introduces what he calls a life-coherent hermeneutic.
Right. A method of interpretation.
Yes. A life-coherent interpretation means we filter our laws, our history, and our actions through one overarching priority. Does this actually keep vulnerable people alive? Think about the medical analogy again.
The treadmill?
A similar idea. If a physician sees the early, cascading symptoms of a fatal disease, they don't sit back and wait for the autopsy to confirm the diagnosis so they can write a perfectly accurate death certificate.
Sure, they treat the symptoms.
Exactly. Saheli outlines a process of what he calls de-lifing. It doesn't start with death camps. It starts with mythic accusation and moral separation. Then it moves to material dispossession, starvation, and the systematic destruction of the life ground.
The fundamental conditions for survival.
Right. Access to food, clean water, functioning hospitals. International law must treat the deliberate, widespread destruction of the life ground as an actionable trigger. The unique specificities of the 1940s shouldn't blind us to the mechanics of disposability happening right now.
Yes, but the physician in your analogy still has to correctly identify the underlying disease, right?
Well, yeah.
If a doctor treats a severe systemic infection with aggressive chemotherapy just because they are panicked about cancer, they don't save the patient. They actively harm them.
That's a fair point, but
the sequence Saheli identifies in the Holocaust involved Jewish people being marked as cosmic, biological enemies. They were stripped of citizenship and methodically transported across a continent purely to be annihilated.
But the mechanism of rendering a population disposable is what we need to watch for.
To map that precise blueprint onto a military response to the October 7th atrocities, a response occurring in a densely populated urban environment, against an adversary intentionally holding hostages is analytically dangerous. It risks weaponizing Holocaust memory to strip a state of its right to self-defense.
See, I think that brings us to a massive blind spot the paper exposes. It's not just that international law is slow. It's that our modern diagnostic tools are structurally engineered to not see the harm.
You're talking about the AI section now.
Yes, the proof of principle in his author's note regarding frontier artificial intelligence. Sully attempted to use advanced AI tools to generate conceptual figures for his paper, visualizations explaining how dehumanization operates so they could be recognized and prevented.
And the AI blocked him.
Completely blocked his requests. It triggered safety restrictions and produced these sterile, useless substitutes.
Because of the RLHF training, reinforcement learning from human feedback.
Exactly. The companies building these tools train the models to prioritize brand safety and avoid legal liability. When Saheli asks the AI to visualize dehumanization, the AI just sees dehumanization keywords and hits the kill switch.
So you see this as procedural capture.
It perfectly illustrates it. The safety architecture optimizes for liability protection. It censors a life-coherent, academic diagnosis of violence because the machine cannot tell the difference between hate speech and a scholar exposing hate speech.
They put a procedural blindfold on us.
Right. The institutions supposed to inform us are structurally biased towards safe corporate abstraction.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered that the AI's refusal is actually a highly successful implementation of the paper's own necessary safeguards?
How so? It literally prevented an atrocity prevention scholar from visualizing atrocity prevention.
Because the system is correctly recognizing the inherent explosive volatility of the imagery requested. We just talked about how difficult it is to separate context from mechanism.
Sure, but context matters.
The AI cannot reliably distinguish between reproducing dehumanization and critically exposing it. But frankly, neither can human political discourse on the internet. I posit that this isn't malicious procedural capture. It is a strictly necessary guardrail.
A guardrail that stops academic research?
If you allow an automated, mass-scale system to generate explicit images of dehumanization, you risk the mass automation of the very cultural violence and anti-Semitic tropes the author warns against. The AI is simply applying the precautionary principle.
That sounds perfectly reasonable until you realize who that safety system is actually protecting.
You think it's just protecting the brand?
It's not protecting vulnerable life. It's protecting the institution itself. Sadly points out that harm is avoided at the superficial level of content categories, but deeper structural harm is left completely unchallenged.
Meaning the anti-genocidal work gets sidelined.
Exactly. If our technology and academic gatekeepers sanitize the language of repair because it feels too legally risky, then anti-genocidal work becomes structurally underfunded and undervisualized. The ruling order doesn't have to ban critique directly. It just has to make the language of repair violate the terms of service.
But Saheli also writes that safety is essential. The lesson of his AI experiment isn't that safety filters are unnecessary, but that they must be life coherent.
Right. I would argue that blocking the generation of anti-Semitic or Islamophobic imagery, even in an academic context, is profoundly life coherent in a digital age. The moment an image is generated, context is immediately stripped away. The algorithm is recognizing that digital memory is easily captured by bad actors.
Which provides the perfect logical bridge to how this exact dynamic plays out in the real world, not just in AI. You mean mapping this to international law?
Yes. If automated systems can't distinguish between the critique of structural violence and violence itself, international law also struggles. It struggles to distinguish between legitimate self-defense and structural violence when a state uses historical trauma as a procedural shield.
Aha. We are moving to the concept of the enthroned wound.
We are. And I see why you think that AI safety is just a guardrail, but let me give you a different perspective on political safety. Saheli defines an enthroned wound as a dynamic or past historical suffering is elevated to grant a state license for domination and geopolitical immunity.
Which is an incredibly fraught concept to apply here.
It is, but it's the crux of the argument. When the memory of the Holocaust is captured in this way, it shields Western powers from accountability. It creates a morally unacceptable hierarchy of human life.
Where Israeli life is treated as grievable and deserving of absolute protection.
And Palestinian life is rendered ungrievable and disposable. The memory of past atrocity is effectively used to insulate the state from reciprocal legal constraints today.
I have serious, fundamental reservations about this framing. We have to look closely at the vital safeguards Saheli himself builds into the text to prevent this exact argument from slipping into anti-Semitism.
He is very clear on those safeguards.
He insists unequivocally that the horror of October 7th and the atrocities committed by Hamas must be condemned without ambiguity. He notes that Israeli civilians are never legitimate targets.
Absolutely.
Framing Israel's security posture primarily as an enthroned wound minimizes the harsh reality of active, ongoing, existential threats to their life ground. There are rockets. There are hostages. Doesn't the aggressive application of this concept risk collective blame?
I understand that concern, but I don't believe the paper falls into that trap.
How does it avoid it? Doesn't it penalize a state for honoring its historical memory while it attempts to achieve mutual survivability?
Because the paper explicitly distinguishes between legitimate security and security as domination. Saheli writes that no people can become genuinely secure by making another people permanently unsafe.
Okay, but
when international law is essentially suspended, when temporary pauses in fighting coexist with broader policies that systematically destroy the fundamental conditions of life, the food systems, the water purification, the hospitals, that is not mutual survivability.
But applying a term like de-lifing to the tragic complexities of the current war can inadvertently trigger the exact collapse of distinctions Saheli warns against.
This is why the definitions matter.
Right. If you're a listener trying to navigate this, we have frameworks like the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance Definition of Antisemitism, and the JDA, the Jerusalem Declaration on Antisemitism.
They exist precisely to help us navigate this tension.
Exactly. They clarify that criticizing the policies of the State of Israel is not inherently anti-Semitic. However, when the Jewish state is uniquely demonized, or when its military actions in a complex urban war are automatically equated with industrialized extermination camps, we cross a line into cultural violence.
But the paper directly, aggressively addresses that tension. It argues that Jewish life must be protected from anti-Semitism, and Palestinian life must be protected from disposability.
Yes, those duties are not rivals.
They are mutually required by the exact same life-coherent ethical law. The enthroned wound concept absolutely does not mean Jewish suffering wasn't profound or historically unique. It means that the sanctity belongs to the living human person, not to the institutional power of the state.
I agree entirely that a world that cannot protect Palestinians is not life-coherent, just as a world that cannot protect Jews is not life-coherent. But the mechanism of how we adjudicate these things matters profoundly.
It does.
If we stretch the specific historical rupture of the Holocaust to adjudicate complex contemporary conflicts, we risk unraveling the very legal, historical, and conceptual clarity that protects all of us. If we call every devastating war a genocide, the word loses its power to shock and mobilize the world.
Or, conversely, if we restrict the word genocide only to exact replicas of the 1940s, complete with the exact same industrial mechanisms, we ensure that the world is never mobilized in time to stop a modern catastrophe.
It is an incredibly razor-thin line Saheli is walking.
It really is. Let me try to summarize my position on what that world requires. Fulfilling the true moral obligation of Holocaust memory means it must transcend retrospective ritual. It has to become an active, life-coherent obligation.
Moving from never again for us to never again for anyone.
Exactly. To prevent sacred memory from becoming an instrument of autopoietic state power, we must embrace equal grievability. We have to be willing to recognize the structural warning signs of dispositionality long before we reach catastrophic, undeniable certainty.
We can't wait for the autopsy.
Right. We cannot let procedural capture, whether it's hard-coded into the safety algorithms of our AI or embedded in the slow bureaucracy of our international courts, blind us to the mechanics of delifing happening right in front of us.
And to summarize, my stance, human life must be protected universally. There is absolutely no disagreement there. But stretching the specific, industrialized, historical rupture of the Holocaust to adjudicate modern urban warfare risks unraveling vital legal and historical distinctions.
Distinctions like the IHRA and the JDA?
Yes, they exist for a reason. They protect Jewish life from the very real threat of anti-Semitic collapse. We have to maintain the historical specificity of the Holocaust in order to protect its universal moral radiance. If we lose the precision of our diagnostic tools, we risk automating cultural violence.
I think we have arrived at a very strong, very necessary point of convergence here, and it's rooted right in the paper's central maxim: no wound denied, no wound enthroned.
We fundamentally agree that historical trauma must never be ignored or erased.
But we also agree that trauma cannot grant any institution or any state immunity from moral reciprocity and international law.
Absolutely. The suffering of the past cannot be weaponized to justify the suffering of the present. Both Jewish grief and Palestinian grief must be held together.
without falling into a toxic trap of competitive victimhood.
The profound challenge we are left with is how to actually build institutions that are capable of doing this, from the slow deliberations of the International Court of Justice to the rapid black box safety filters of frontier AI models.
It's an incredibly demanding framework. Dr. Sahali has provided a civilizational diagnostic that leaves all of us, policymakers, technologists, and everyday citizens, with a heavy responsibility.
It forces us to look in the mirror and ask what we are actually conserving when we say we are remembering the past.
Which brings us right back to the treadmill. The stress test is running, the incline is steep, the system is under immense pressure, and the hidden fault lines of our global institutions are fully exposed.
The question is no longer whether the system is struggling.
Right. The question is whether we have the courage to read the diagnostic warning signs, adjust our institutions, and intervene in time to actually save the patient.